It's almost midnight on Sunday, and I'm going on probably 4 hours sleep, closing Halloween, working a Sunday morning, my life spinning, making connections. And maybe it was in my vast, near catatonic coma state that I decided to sign up for NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel Writing Month. 50,000 words in 30 days. I've always loved to write. I have a blog that's not really that active. Months ago, I had started a short story and never finished, and I'm working on a play right now and a couple of screenplays, so I have stuff on the go, but I think this will allow me to focus on something for 30 days. I have some ideas, but we'll see where it goes. I may wake up tomorrow and say, screw it, and realize I don't have the time, but I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a great adventure, great challenge, and we will see where it leads to. Speaking of where things lead to, today's show is an adventure in philosophical and spiritual queries. Whether it be decoding the words of Alice in Wonderland, or how ancient Greek theology and the philosophies of Maslow influence modern sculpture, or how the Tibetan Book of the Dead inspired a new 21-day theater piece from a Vancouver art collective. We all have questions about how the world works, and art is a great way of exploring them. And that's what today's show is all. David Day and I have a few things in common. We both spent our childhoods in Victoria, BC, on the tip of Vancouver Island, and it was a lovely, lovely place to grow up. He also now lives in Toronto, which is the city where I was born, although I didn't spend a significant amount of time there. We also have a love of and for literature and mathematics and fantasy. You see, David Day has written over 40 books. He's done 7 books on the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, including The Burroughs Bestiary, A Tolkien Bestiary, Tolkien, An Illustrated Encyclopedia, A to Z of Tolkien, Tolkien's Ring, The Hobbit Companion, and Tolkien's World. He's also done 2 on the Arthurian legend of King Arthur, Castles and the Quest for King Arthur. He's written 7 books of poetry, 9 books for children, and 10 on natural history. His book titled The Doomsday Book of Animals, which was later published as The Encyclopedia of Vanished Species, was a book of the year for Time Magazine, New Scientist, and the Los Angeles Times. His new book has been over 20 years in the making. He originally started it while living in Britain in the 1990s and initially planned on a 1998 release to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the death of one Charles Dodgson, also known as Lewis Carroll. 17 years later, the book is finally out, and in it he explores what he feels are the true and hidden meanings in the text of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. It is called Alice's Adventures in Wonderland Decoded, the full text of Lewis Carroll's novels with its many hidden meanings. And the author is David Day, and I had the privilege of speaking with him earlier this week about. David Day, hello, welcome to the show, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you wrote Alice's Adventures in Wonderland Decoded. Now, I know in the past you had done a lot of work investigating Middle Earth and in the land of Tolkien. What made you decide to tackle Lewis Carroll this time around?
I think it was just serendipitous in a way. I just finished a book on Tolkien, and the publisher said, "Well, there's an anniversary, 100 years since the death of Lewis Carroll. Would you be interested in doing a book on Alice?" And I said, "Well, you know, it's a small book. How difficult can this be? You know." And so I started reading it, and I read it as a child, and sort of it seemed simple enough. And then as an adult reading it, I started to realize what James Joyce was studying when he wrote Finnegan's Wake. It's actually one of the most complex pieces of writing I've ever encountered. And I soon found that 2 years wasn't sufficient. I ended up spending 18 years trying to decode it. It's it made 37,000 years of Tolkien's history seem quite simple by comparison.
It is inherently a children's book, but what do you think makes it so much more complex than even something like a Tolkien?
It's in the language, and it's partly why. I mean, it's an extraordinary book because it's been translated more than any other book in the world. Aside from the Bible and the Quran and religious texts. I mean, there are 176, it's published in 176 languages, and it's also in, like, each language has multiple translators. I mean, there are 400 Spanish versions of it and 500 French versions of it. Vladimir Nabokov, who wrote Lolita, did the first Russian translation a long time back. There's something about it is a kind of a word spell that's working in it. It creates the complexity of the language is because it's operating on multiple levels. Physicists quote it, mathematicians, politicians, musicians, computer geeks, they all find something quotable. He's the most quoted author after Shakespeare. And it's because it appeals on all these different levels, and in fact, it is written on multiple levels. I could teach the history of mathematics up until 1850 using Alice as the Alice story as a basis, or philosophy up until then.
I wanted to touch on that because I know Dodgson is his real name.
Yeah.
Had basically he was a mathematician, and yeah. I'm curious as to whether sort of looking at the literature from that aspect perhaps explains some of its intricacies and its complexities in a way that perhaps just standard literature can't.
It's absolutely right. The mathematics embedded in it is quite extraordinary. I mean, some of it is sort of absurd. For instance, the Cheshire Cat. For me, this was sort of a breakthrough moment when I understood what he was doing. He does sort of multi-discipline punning. And like the smile like a Cheshire Cat or the grin like a Cheshire Cat was an expression that was around for a couple hundred years before Alice in Wonderland. But he gives the mathematician's explanation for it. He said, what kind of cat can smile? In mathematics, it's a catenary. A catenary is a suspension bridge is a catenary curve. It's the shape of a chain makes when it hangs, and from two points, and that was his kind of humor was to use what we call formal languages, where a mathematician uses English, but it means something very specific in mathematics. The same with philosophers and computer geeks. I mean, is the whole last chapter, for instance, of the trial of the Knave of Hearts. Is basically an exercise in Boolean algebra, which is an exercise in reducing language, basically reducing thought and logic into binary systems. It's the basis of all our computer languages now. Okay. And he was at the turning point in history as a mathematician when we were finding what became the basis of computer language, which sort of explains why. Computer people are sort of fascinated with him. Although the latest computer game I've seen on Alice is she turns into some sort of axe murderer going through Wonderland. But it's embedded in the language. And that's why, so much of what he writes, he refers to as nonsense, but it's not nonsense at all. It has a logical structure underneath it. If it was pure nonsense, it wouldn't be funny. It just wouldn't make sense at all. It would be chaotic. So on one level, his writing appeals to us because it does make sense, even if we don't understand why.
I'm curious as to what role his social status played in all this, because it seems to me that because he was able to hang out with sort of the elites and the intellectuals and then satirized him, that's in part what made the book successful.
Yes, it was. The interesting thing is, of course, was that he probably wouldn't have had a chance of being in contact with Alice and her sisters or all the Pre-Raphaelite artists who he met. And the reason that he was able to do that as a sort of lower middle class person, I mean, Alice was an aristocrat, but because of he was a photographer, it was like 3 years after it became legal and out of copyright for collodion photography, he got a camera. And at that time, you pretty well were stuck with getting a portrait painter or no image at all of anybody. The collodion plate system, you almost had to be a chemistry major to get to actually use this process, but it's a kind of thing that he loved, was this detailed attention to detail kind of art form. And for years he went around and he became almost a stalker of celebrities. I mean, at one point he sort of pursues Tennyson's family from one end of England to the other in an attempt to get photographs of Tennyson. And he starts by getting encountering his wife and children and taking their photographs and working his way up. So it's an interesting, I mean, he took photographs of one of Queen Victoria's sons. He tried to get the Prince of Wales, but failed. So it was like for the sort of social climbing aspect of it. And he was what was interesting is he frequently would just sort of pop up somewhere and present his card and sort of basically gate crash. In several cases he gate crashed painting exhibitions and stuff. But once he became famous himself, he wouldn't talk to anybody who wasn't formally introduced, and any correspondence that was sent to the university with Lewis Carroll was sent back, person unknown, and he was quite extraordinary in that sort of he wasn't willing to give anybody else an in that wasn't properly introduced to him on that level.
He seems to be quite interesting because, you know, he was a writer, he was an artist, but he was also, at least it seems to me from sort of the introduction you wrote about him, very conservative and sort of going against any sort of social change of the day, which is sort of, I guess, maybe slightly unusual for someone in his creative profession. What do you make of that?
Yes, he was extremely conservative, and the unusual thing is that he was incredibly creative so far as the writing was concerned in the language, and very progressive in terms of mathematics and everything. But he was very dyed-in-the-wool conservative, was really against any change in the system. This is unfortunate because his boss and Alice's father was the dean of Christ Church, and his job was to bring in liberal changes into the system. And in fact, her father was mainly the main vehicle for the modernization of university systems. That he decided that even though he was the top Greek scholar of the day, he decided that it wasn't necessary for a science degree to have Greek as a language. Lewis Carroll was so upset by this that he actually resigned his teaching of mathematics because he felt that it was a travesty not to have that engineers really needed to have Greek in order to raise a bridge. But he was also like on the wrong side of almost everything in history. I mean, he was for the Confederate cause during the American Civil War. He was against almost any kind of change in the system of government.
Yeah.
He was a really committed to the idea of a classical education that included Latin and Greek as a basic entry level.
Now, I know, authors such as Tolkien and specifically somebody like C.S. Lewis received a lot of criticism for having, Christian, morals sort of infused. Specifically, I'm thinking of the end of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. There was a lot of criticism for having overtly Christian themes in their work. Did that same sort of criticism befall Lewis Carroll at all?
No, he really, it's quite interesting because he was a really devout Christian, but he felt like he couldn't write anything that was in any way using what he considered sacred material. So he was consciously not using any allusions to religion in his work. He felt that was the job of the church, and that was the job of people going to mass, and they had that there. His work was consciously non-Christian in its allusions, because he felt he didn't want to mess with the sacred material. And even like at one point in the Looking Glass, someone pointed out that one of the flowers in the garden was a passion flower, and that was his original description of it, but he decided decided that that was too much of an allusion to Christ and the Passion, so he changed it to Tiger Lily, just so it would have no implication. It would consider a sacred, you know, treading on Christianity.
I mean, you're not the first author to try and decode the hidden meanings in Alice in Wonderland. What makes your version different than some of the other academic studies that have been out there?
Yeah, there are thousands of books and studies of Lewis Carroll's Alice, but I think mine's the only one that actually tries to make a real sense out of it. Virtually all of them say it's just a series of random sketches that make no sense, really, in terms of it. And my argument is that basically there's a mythological text in it, that in fact Alice is the oldest story in the world. It's the descent of the goddess into the underworld, which is actually the oldest written records we have of Mesopotamia, of the goddess of spring going into the underworld and then reemerging. And our most the most popular mythological form and allusion of his life during his lifetime, in fact during the whole Victorian age, was the story of Persephone's descent into the underworld and rising out. And that's what's happening with Alice. The story is that she's encountering all these people in this underground adventure. By the way, the original title of Alice in Wonderland was actually Alice's Adventures Underground. So it was specifically a reference to this descent into the underworld. And each one of the characters, she learns a lesson from them and eventually overcomes the Queen of Hearts and reemerges into the world. So it's really giving a child an education on a spiritual level right through. And I don't think anybody's ever even proposed that, even though it seems a fairly obvious thing. Everybody had a classical background of that period who was educated. Yeah. And that mythological form was the most popular one of the day.
I guess it begs the question. I mean, you know, is this something that is, you know, necessary? Or, you know, is it better for us to leave, you know, books and art just as they are?
Well, yes, it's I mean, basically, as children learn it on one level, it can be like it made a very good Disney movie. It depends on which level you want to approach it on. It's like saying, for instance, that he would say that, you know, for instance, you don't have to appreciate the mathematics of music in order to have your soul lifted by the spirit of it. I mean, this is for people who want to look at Alice, and I think that we all know, like everybody, when you read Alice, you sort of know it's about something else. We just don't know what it is. Like Alice says about Jabberwocky, "It fills my head with ideas, but I don't know what they are." This book is about what they are, and it's for people that are interested in those ideas, yes.
Now, I know you're not necessarily the most popular person among the Tolkien community and fans of Tolkien for the work that you've done on him. But how do you think, or do you think that this work would be more, you know, might be more accepted in the literary community at all?
The I'd like to take that up about the Tolkien group, which I call the Tolkien Taliban. The majority of those people have taken up a little campaign, it's a handful of people, but they keep on writing into Amazon and everything like that, and they're. I mean, they gave a whole. I gave a whole list of abuse that they wrote about me, and it's that, on that list. But each one of them say they've never read a word I've written. So they say everybody knows that this is unreliable, but they themselves have never read my work, but nobody should buy it. And I said it's like a handful of people that around the Tolkien Society. They're incredibly abusive and don't understand the context of the work at all.
It seems to me that a lot of the books that are, you know, I guess studied today by literature students and by academics tend to be from the Victorian era up until sort of, you know, the earliest 20th century when you get to Narnia. What do you think it is about that time period that makes it so rich, not only for original works of literature, but also to have a lot of them be classified as classics and be studied so frequently?
Well, you have to remember it was in Lewis Carroll's time, it was a much smaller world in terms of, first of all, he was only writing for about 20% of the population at maximum. 80% of the population was virtually illiterate. The average education in Britain at that time was 2 years of elementary school, and many had no education whatsoever. The year that Alice was born, they just reduced the working hours of children in factories to 10 hours a day. So he was writing for the fairly exclusive group. And what's interesting about this book of mine is that it shows that, like, all these people in the art, the artists, the photographers, the paint, the writers, all knew each other, basically. And it allowed for big experiments, because publishers in those days were, in fact, largely distributors. Lewis Carroll actually paid for his own book to be published and printed. And then Macmillan Publishers was basically a distributor of it. I don't think that any of his works would get past the children's book editor right now, because they have rules about the idea of what a children's book is. There were no rules then. So he put in things that, you know, weren't addressing children directly, often, that were about political scenes of the day and other aspects of life that was in there, which makes it quite fascinating. But, you know, looking at what children's books are now, it wouldn't have had a chance of getting published.
You know, given that you've been with this book for almost 20 years now, what would you say ultimately that Alice in Wonderland is actually about?
That's almost impossible to answer. it's about whatever people want to read into it right now. I think you can take it out of context. You can take lines out of context and apply it to, I'd say, politics, to anything. Even 5 years after he was published, there was somebody wrote a piece called Alice's Adventures in Westminster about the politics there. People picked up on it very early that it had all these layers under it, and then they applied their own rules to it. And there's constant, you know, re-examinations of it. For instance, there's a book called Gadell, Lesher, and Bach by Douglas Hofstadter, and it's about 1,000 pages. And it's just the focal point of the whole thing is one of Lewis Carroll's little stories called Achilles and the Tortoise. And he uses it as a lead-in to understanding artificial intelligence. And again, the reason that it is possible to do that is because Lewis Carroll was dealing with logic and Boolean ideas at that time that fit in with what became artificial intelligence and computer language.
Do you think, or how do you think Lewis Carroll changed literature at all, if at all? How did he change children's literature as we see it?
Well, it became kind of a symbolic language that he was, for one thing, he was really innovative in the way he printed the books. He designed them using Tenniel's illustration, where you combined text and illustration on the same page. That was never done before. The illustration was always separate from that. So he was quite innovative in those things, and he was very careful about the illustrations. Each one of the illustrations had to be looked at by him. And like another illustrator who illustrated one of his Sylvia and Bruno books, which were these novels later on, he got in an argument with him over his payment because he said he took a square inch of Tenniel's drawings and found that Tenniel had used twice as many lines in his drawings as this other illustrator did. And so he thought he should only pay him half as much. Which I think is kind of a bad attitude towards art. I don't know what he would have thought of Picasso getting paid £25,000 for his portrait of Shakespeare that consisted of three lines.
Well, the book is Alice's Adventures in Wonderland Decoded. It's out now. David Day, thank you so much for your time today.
Right, thank you.
Alrighty, have a good one. Cheers. From literature, we moved to the visual arts. We moved to sculpture. And sculpture is one of the oldest forms of art in the world, going back to the times of ancient Greece, ancient Rome, even the Egyptians. And sculptures have long been influenced by mythology, whether it's Greek mythology or Roman mythology or Egyptian mythology. And, you know, they represent angels and gods and spirit. But what can they tell us about ourselves, about society, humanity, and life? Blake Ward is a Canadian sculptor who recently opened a new exhibit here in Vancouver. It's called Depth and Perception, and it's mostly sculpted using bronze. And it's very modern, yet you do get a feel of the ancient world and the mythology of it all. We had a very fascinating conversation. We drifted into the philosophical, almost the metaphysical, spirituality, religion, art, technology, with him, and I spoke to his co-collaborator on our project, Boki Hackle. And his exhibit is on now until November 16th, and it'll be going to Edmonton in the spring. So this is my conversation with Blake Ward and Boki Hackle. I am here with sculptor Blake Ward. Hello, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
The new exhibit is Depth and Perception. But how, and I'll get to that in a minute, but how does one get into sculpting as an art form?
Well, I started quite a few years ago and actually studied in Edmonton, Alberta. I studied abstract in the late 70s and then moved to figurative in Europe. I found that there weren't a lot of schools teaching figurative in North America. and figurative was my interest. So I moved to figurative and in Europe and did representational figurative for many years, and then decided that as the work evolved, we moved into more abstract. As you can see, this show, the work is very much abstract. This is work that has been done in the last 2 years, and there is the two main, the two principal pieces are Ushaptis, and Ushaptis are built, they're named after the Egyptian sculptures. And my collaborator Boki Hackel has been creating those with me over the last year, and Boki was originally a conceptual artist, so she's brought a lot of the conceptual to the abstract, and we call it depth and perception because there's the interiors of the works have been opened up, and we are inviting you to look inside, not only the sculpture, but inside yourselves.
Sculpting is one of the oldest art forms in a way. I mean, it goes all the way back to the Greek and Romans. How do you sort of take a really old art form and modernize it, or is that not the point?
Well, I think that is the point. I think that we need to be contemporary and reflect our time. The figurative has been, actually dates back to the Willendorf. Is one of the earliest figurative sculptures found, and that dates back some 30,000 years ago. So it is a very old art form. Perhaps painting's been around as long, it just didn't survive. But I think that it's really important to try and be, to reflect the times, and from that point of view, I think that the figure has gone through abstraction, and personally, I'm bringing it back a bit to the representational, although these works are definitely partial figures, and they're definitely abstracted to a certain extent. The surface area is abstracted. So I've tried to push the work further. Certainly, they're unique for figurative. You won't find much figurative like this. In my work that I'm doing now, I'm actually mixing the analog, what I call analog handmade sculpture, with the digital, and we're pushing it further into 3D printing, where I'll print the molds. I think it's important to talk about our time today in any art.
And also, I think that the methodology that we use, and be it with the bronzes, even if we're just molding a figure at the 360 degrees in a circle, I mean, we're using methods that are ancient. And yet, now with 3D printing, it's really a marriage between the past and the future. And what it brings about, hopefully, is the sculpture of the 21st century.
On that note, how has technology, in sort of the broadest sense of the word, how has that changed the way artists can approach their craft, do you think?
Well, a lot of it hasn't changed very. I mean, the bronze has been made the same way, principally, since for several thousand years. So I think it's time that we see digital. I think it's time we see the 3D scans and prints get involved, and that's probably where we're going to go. So I think I'm very encouraged. I love the idea of mixing the digital with the analog, and I think it reflects our time. So hopefully that's where more and more sculptors will go.
Do you think, on that note, do you think that art of, you know, any medium, whether it's, you know, sculpting, visual arts, theater, film, can it be is it the cultural voice of a generation?
I think contemporary work should and does reflect the their time, and I certainly try and make sure that my work does reflect what's happening today. This show, Depth of Perception, we've put on the walls some words which it's a Carl Jung quote, and it reflects our awakening, if you like, the change in consciousness that we're seeing today, and I think that most arts, theater, painting, and certainly I try to make, we work very hard to get our work to reflect what's happening today.
Art zeitgeist, really.
Yeah. The collaborative process between you two, how did that come about? How did that sort of, you know, evolve as this exhibit, you know, came together?
Well, it really came very, very naturally. We started to work together, creating the pieces. We make the sculpture in wax, and so we're pouring this wax, and we just it just sort of happened. We allowed it to happen, though, and encouraged it, but there again, a lot of the conceptual, Boki is a conceptual artist, and so a lot of the concept behind it also began to just grow as we talked about it and we discussed what we were doing and where we were going with the pieces. I found in the foundry we would both be working on the same piece, and it was natural. We seemed to see the same things. We knew what needed to be repaired, and
we didn't even have to talk, which is quite amazing when you're working.
So one of the nice things about this collaboration was it's unique in that I like to collaborate with other people, but I've never experienced collaboration like this.
I think artists in their nature are very collaborative people.
I would agree, yes.
I think in almost any medium of art, you see a lot of collaboration. What do you think it is about that lifestyle, perhaps, you know, that way of thinking that breeds so much inherent collaboration and communication together?
Well, I think that in the theatrical arts, you have to collaborate. It's all about people and working with each other. Some of the other arts can be very solitary. Painting, for example, could be very, very solitary. But I found, and as can sculpture, but I found that really the work benefits from a collaboration, from new ideas, from another point of view. And so I enjoy it very much, and I expect that we will be doing more of it. Perhaps it's, again, part of our time.
Also, I think artists naturally have a need to express themselves and to share their thoughts, their emotions, and it comes through in the work. And I think that's another reason why it's so important and it's so prevalent amongst artists to collaborate.
Yeah. I was looking through the book here. That's got all your... got a lot of photos. And I'm struck... A lot of the names of the pieces have goddess or angel in them, and it reminds me of, you know, as we were talking about earlier, the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, the ancient Egyptians. The reason for naming the sculptures as you did, was it sort of a perhaps homage to the history of the medium, or was there some other reasoning behind it?
No, I think we're really talking to, addressing the human spirit, and I wanted to name them after angels and Ushaptis, which are the Egyptian goddesses and gods, and the Babylonians, and I think today we've got, we don't, We don't want to mix religion with spirit. I want to keep that completely apart. But the human spirit is something that's becoming, I think, is developing and becoming very, very much zeitgeist today, along with the consciousness and meditation people are into, the yoga. And I think that along with it comes this idea that there is some other form, some other energy, if you like. And I wanted to address that in the work. I think that is part of what's happening today.
It's also sort of a commentary on a post-mythological era, this post-mythological world that we live in now.
Do you think that is a natural stage of human evolution that we're seeing in this dialogue that we're having about, you know, spirituality, philosophy, metaphysics, or, you know, has there been perhaps some event maybe that has stirred our awakening on these issues?
I think it's evolution. We're evolving as we educate and as we are opening our minds more to many things. That energy is evolving from the mythological to a more open consciousness, and that's one of the reasons why we wanted to address the spiritual rather than religious.
Why is it important for you to at least explore consciousness, spirituality?
I think it's part of our time. I think that many people, it's grown over the years, certainly, and Carl Jung again said, he who looks outside dreams, he who looks inside awakes. And I think that's very much where we are today. We're awakening to ourselves, what is our inner landscapes, our soulscapes.
And we have a choice, which I think is really important in today's society.
You've been pretty clear in making a distinction between the spiritual themes that you're exploring and religion. How do you see the two?
Well, I think that this is post-mythological, and the religion deals with an exterior God, where we're talking about an interior consciousness, an interior energy, and an interior spirit. So I believe, even though perhaps 80% of the world's population is still stuck in the mythological, many of the more enlightened, if you like, are way past that, and could never return.
But respectfully, I think that also what it's talking about is tolerance. It's education.
Very much so, yeah.
And tolerance. Everyone gets to believe whatever they want to, and that's okay.
I feel like that's, you know, and I come from the theater world, so maybe this, I'm biased in a certain way, but I feel like that sort of way of thinking is very common among artists today, that artists from whatever medium seem to have maybe a greater sensitivity or a greater sense of tolerance that you might not find in other occupations. What is it about the artist's way of life that you think maybe brings about a greater sense of self and a greater sense of sort of loving those around you?
Well, I think you said it yourself in your question. It's about sensitivity, and artists tend to be more sensitive, even hypersensitive, much to our own chagrin, really.
I think that we also look at trying to reflect the society, the culture around us in our work, and if we're true to ourselves, I don't think we can help but reflect that if we're speaking the truth, we need to tell about our culture and our society in our work.
We've been talking a lot about, you know, how we're in the post-mythological age, so to speak. But given that sculpture, I think, is in many ways so inherently entwined to the gods of Egypt, the gods of Greece, the gods of Rome, I'm wondering if there was any research on your part involving, you know, mythology, like Joseph Campbell or anything like that.
Well, definitely, very, very much so. We have been very involved in trying to present, and this is why we're using the names, why we name these pieces after angels, and Ushap, Greek gods and goddesses, and Egyptian, and because we want to juxtapose one period with the other. We want to introduce the idea that there is more research for each of us to do, not only within ourselves, but within our history and the history that has been recorded over the centuries about our civilizations as they have evolved. This is very much an evolution, and we wanted to work to reflect that. Speak about that.
Yeah, and also we do that on many levels. It's not only on the conceptual level, but even on the, as I said earlier, on the methodology, where we really try to intertwine the centuries, really.
You brought up the word enlightenment earlier, or, you know, and how a lot of artists are enlightened or perhaps perceived as enlightened by a lot of other people. How would you describe what enlightenment is?
Well, I think that's an individual idea, and I think that it's something, if you talk about some philosophies, they speak of enlightenment. I think as an artist, I would say the closest that I could come to it is the actual creative spirit, where I'm taking the ideas, I'm taking that energy and producing something, object art, something material with it, rather than just the concept or just the philosophy, and leaving that for someone else to interpret. And so for me, that's as close as I think I will get, but that doesn't mean I'll stop trying.
I mean, Maslow always said that, you know, enlightenment was the highest point in life we can achieve. Do you agree with that? Is there something that, like, is beyond nirvana?
I don't think I'm qualified to answer that. But, you know, Maslow talked about needs, and definitely enlightenment is something that becomes the search. Becomes a need, although a luxury. Although here again, there, I think one of what we're trying to do is trying to sort of chasing that dream, if you like.
Yeah, because serenity, I think, is enlightenment in many ways, and achieving that serenity, that's something that comes in the process of creation. For me, anyway.
You brought up luxury, and it seems to me that, like, being able to not only create these sculptures but also view them is a luxury for many of us. But how do they also fit a need? Can a luxury be a need?
Well, I think the creative to create has become a need for us, and we have the luxury of creating. So the need is expression. I have something to say, we have something to say, we need to say that. I don't know where Maslow would put that in the requirements of what our needs are, but it certainly is a luxury to be able to not only express yourself, but have the opportunity to expose that to other people, to the public, and get their interpretations and their responses.
What do you want people to experience, take away when they come in and view your sculptures?
Well, I would hope that they might look inside themselves, and that would be an experience that might lead to other things that they would personally feel. We're always chasing emotions, and if I can have a viewer, if there's an emotive response from a viewer, then I've been successful, I think. Yeah. If they think about it just for a moment, then I have been successful in the work. The work is doing what I'm hoping it would do.
Well, the exhibit is Depth and Perception, and it opens when officially?
29th, Thursday, this Thursday coming, 29th of October, runs to the 19th of November here at Petley Jones Gallery in Vancouver.
Vancouver, and then next spring you're going to Edmonton, yes?
We will take it to Edmonton. We did show it in Toronto earlier in September, and it was very well received. Now I'm very excited to be here in Vancouver. I know this art scene it's a wonderful scene and a very expanding place for arts today in Canada.
Blake Ward, Bucky Hackle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dan.
Thank you so much.
That's it for the show this week. My thanks to David Day. My thanks to Blake Ward and Boki Hackle. You can follow me on Twitter at Endeavors Radio. You can follow my co-producer on Twitter at Lehman, LEAMINN. Please find us on the web at www.podswithbenefits.com. If you like the show, please consider supporting us. Cheers, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.